Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us on the Smart Family Podcast today. I'm your co-host, Dr. Rob Meter. Hey, and whether you're tuning in on your commute or on your AirPods while driving or going for a run or doing the dishes, welcome and thanks for making the time to listen to this episode. And hey, I cannot believe we are on episode 40 already. What a great year and a bit it has been. And thank you for all your feedback as well. Because when it comes to parenting, you know, we have had some great feedback on episodes with Dr. Ross Green and Mona Delahook, Jennifer Kalari, Dr. Russell Barkley on ADHD, Dr. Jean Clinton most recently. And we've really appreciated what you've had to say about those episodes. So thank you for that. Now, listen, a few months ago, I posted a picture on Instagram of my bookshelf, giving you a picture of what books I have been reading lately and have been recommending to my patients and families that I see in my office. And then I also asked what you were reading and enjoying and got some great feedback. So thank you for that. And we took that feedback to think about, hey, who else should we invite for the podcast? And I'm happy to say that today's guest, Dr. Stuart Shanker, came directly from that feedback from you. So thank you. Now, I had actually read Dr. Shanker's latest book, Reframed, recently, and it so happened that I had an opportunity to hear Stuart speak at a conference on childhood trauma not too long ago. And it was fantastic. I mean, it got such great feedback from people in the audience who were listening to his message. And I knew then that we had to have Stuart on the podcast. And when I connected with him, he gladly and generously obliged. And here we are today. So we are sure this episode will move your parenting to the next level as we dive into self-regulation. Now, I admit I tossed that term around somewhat lightly, not thinking too much about exactly what it means. But Dr. Shanker today is going to be great at dissecting what self-regulation really means and also what it doesn't mean. Now, he has written and spoken extensively on this topic around the world and is probably the leading expert on a topic of self-regulation. His book, Self-Reg, is fantastic and probably one of the best books around on how to understand a child's behavior and the impact of stress on behavior. And I really would encourage you to read it, whether you are an educator or a parent or a grandparent or an about-to-be parent. Do read his book. I'm sure it will impact you as much as it did impact me. So, because, you know, seeing behavior through this really a new paradigm will literally revolutionize how you understand not just your children, but really everyone around you. So Dr. Stuart Shanker was educated at the University of Toronto and at Oxford. He is a research professor emeritus of philosophy and psychology at York University in Toronto, Ontario, and the founder and CEO of the Merit Center. He has brought the self-regulation initiative to countless schools, and today he will bring this message to us. Enjoy.
Stuart, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. We are just so thrilled to have you join us.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
This self-reg topic, absolutely love it. I think it would be great to start with something that maybe some of our audience have heard about. Certainly, I should let you know that I tried the marshmallow test on my five-year-old.
As did I.
That was 20 years ago. Yeah. So can you explain to us about the marshmallow test and about the difference between what that test shows and self-regulation?
So it really is a good place to start. For one thing, it's where I myself started. So I had come back to Canada from Oxford and I specialized in self-regulation. We'll get to that later, what it means. Mm-hmm. And everybody was talking about the marshmallow task. And Walter Mischel had set this up. Really, he was interested in self-control. He had been already, when he came to America, I think it was from Austria, he was very interested in trying to tease out self-control. So he designed this test. And his original test, which I believe was done in the late 60s, early 70s, was on young children, children from the ages of 3.5 to close to 6. When I saw the task, and anyone who's listening to this can easily find video of kids doing the marshmallow test. And there was even one done on Sesame Street. So I watched it and I thought, well, this is a classic self-regulation task. This has nothing to do with self-control, but I can see why you'd think it was self-control. So let me just explain it with a caution. I think it's actually a very important test. I think we've learned something important from it, but what we learned didn't have much to do with self-control. If you think about it, so here you are, and we've done this ourselves many, many times at our own institute. You know, you're telling a kid if you wait 15 minutes, you get 2 marshmallows instead of 1. But trust me, another marshmallow is not such a big deal for a kid. And I had a devil of a time trying to do it with my own children because my daughter kept on insisting when she was young she didn't like marshmallows. So we had to figure out a substitute.
I used Oreos.
I actually did the same. I used Oreos. But if you look at it carefully, it's been designed as a classic stress test. And in fact, most of the early psychology tests that were done on children, from roughly speaking the 60s to the 90s, were different kinds of stress tests. In this case, what you're doing is, it's a very uncomfortable situation for a child. They're in a room with absolutely no distractions, no windows. They have a fairly uncomfortable seat, and they've been talked to by a stranger. Now they're told they've got this marshmallow put in front of them, and they're told, don't eat it if you want to have a second one. So what you're really doing is it's in psychology, it's called a prime. And so what you're doing is you're creating in that marshmallow a stressor for the child. And it's the same as, at the beginning of Nanny McPhee, they say to the kids, don't look at her carbuncle. And of course, that's all the children can look at. Okay. So when you watch these children in this test, you'll see that now this marshmallow becomes like the carbuncle. It becomes a huge stressor. And what we found was that a significant percentage of the children don't know how to deal with this stress, about 2/3. And the only way they can actually deal with it is by eating it. They are eating it as actually a way of self-regulating, getting rid of the stress. The ones who pass the test, they have what are called cognitive competencies. So they can self-distract, they can self-soothe. They have very effective ways of dealing with the stress. For us, as a research institute, that created some interesting questions. One was, the 2/3 that were failing, why didn't they have the same capacities to deal with stress by calming themselves? Or the second question, which is equally interesting, did they have those skills, but the situation was so stressful that they lost the skills? They went into something that we call red brain, where they couldn't exercise those skills. Either way, as red as a study of self-regulation, it is enormously interesting. And in my own case, I think it's been very fruitful.
Mm-hmm. So tell us then, why is it so important for children to be able to self-regulate? I think we kind of throw the term around quite loosely. We just want kids to be in control. What is your sort of meaning when you say self-regulation? What does it mean to you and why is it so important?
Again, I love the question because I came here, when I came to Canada, everybody was talking about self-regulation, but they weren't talking about something that I recognized as self-regulation. And in fact, we did a study on this and found that there are 447 different definitions of self-regulation. Those different definitions are variations on self-monitoring, self-control, But the original term, which is the one we use, was coined by Walter Bradford Cannon back in the early 20s and 30s. And their understanding of self-regulation in physiology and then psychophysiology is how we manage stress. Now, this is an enormously important point because the reality is all children self-regulate. They start to self-regulate at the moment of birth. You know, they are assaulted by an array of stresses that they have not encountered in the womb. And so they have to manage these stresses. And you know, as a pediatrician, for some children, they have a very maladaptive mode of dealing with the stress. They shut down. They go into, and this is a worrying sign for pediatricians, because we need that child at least, you know, for several hours of the day. We want them alert so that they're interacting, engaging with mommy or whoever their caregiver is, and learning all these things through, these interactions. Now, where it gets really serious is we are seeing, I'll just stick to Canada, our own data, we're seeing an explosion of stress-related mental health disorders. And in fact, one of your videos was about this very topic. Mm-hmm. And this created a very interesting problem for us. So we know that, for example, the jump, you know, this steep rise in anxiety disorders, depression, or even suicide over the last 20 years, or obesity, these are frightening phenomena. Yeah. Is it because the stress load is simply too great? Are we the most stressed generation ever? Or is it because our children are self-regulating in a maladaptive way? And maladaptive means it may get rid of the stress in the moment, but it creates much more stress down the road. So, you know, dealing with your stress by eating, especially eating foods high in sugar, fat, and salt, that's a maladaptive way of handling your stress. The adaptive way would be to go to mom and dad, mm-hmm. or your caregiver. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's not just a case of saying that we want to be clear that when we're talking about self-regulation, we're referring simply to how we deal with stress. But it for us, it's very important because our whole work is based around distinguishing between maladaptive ways and adaptive ways, or growth-promoting ways of handling stress. And what we think we're seeing in our country, and obviously in the U.S., is a serious increase in maladaptive self-regulation.
I would love to just hear you explain how self-regulation happens, what parts of the brain are involved, so that parents can have an understanding of what's going on.
Well, early on, we adopted a model that we call blue brain, red brain, brown brain. And it's based on the work of an American neuroscientist called Paul MacLean, called the triune brain. So his idea was that the brown brain, that's the brain, the reptilian brain, when you go into fight or flight, that was selected about 300 million years ago. And it was really good for singletons, singleton meaning a solitary creature that is on its own from the moment of birth. But then mammals evolved around 200 million years ago, and they needed another brain. It had to be a brain that was designed not just for caregiving, for raising your young, you know, licking your pups, but also that could identify who were enemies and who were friends among your conspecifics. And then finally, there we get the neocortex that was selected, let's say, around 5 million years ago, and then went through a number of improvements with each new human species. And so MacLean's original idea was that all three brains are present. We have really three brains in one, hence he called it triune. Now, we know today in neuroscience that, in fact, all parts of the brain are involved in any single action. So you can't really talk about three brains in one. Everything's working. But you can talk about which systems are dominant? Which systems are running the show? Is it the neocortex, which is the thinking part of our brain, which solves problems, it's aware, etc.? Or is it the subcortex, the limbic system, which is the source of impulses and urges and strong emotions? For us, there's a couple of reasons why we use this as a sort of shortcut for explaining which part of the brain is dominant. We had a couple of reasons why we did it. And first of all, at the time when I was starting, another buddy of mine, a guy called Alan Shore, was explaining the difference between left brain and right brain. And I'm sure most of your parents have heard about this. You know how right brain is the system for emotional attunement, for attachment. But our problem was in my own neural lab, we were studying something called the amygdala, which is in the subcortex. And the amygdala is in both sides. It spans both hemispheres. So you can't use a bicameral model. We needed something that was really looking at the interplay between the thinking parts of the brain and the sort of non-thinking. Now, there's some very important research that's been done over the last 10 years, which has taught us that, let's just tie it in with stress. When a child is under, or teen, is under chronic heightened stress, what it does is it hyper-arouses the amygdala, the system deep inside the limbic system, deep inside the subcortex. So it hyper-arouses the amygdala, but at the same time, it suppresses certain systems in the blue brain, in the neocortex. Under heightened stress, the child or youth has much less awareness of what they're saying or doing, and they're not even aware of what's happening in their body. They may not be aware that they're hungry, or they may not even be aware that they're hurt. Instead, their behavior is being governed by a system that has its own little alarm in it that is looking everywhere for danger, for threats. And if it senses a threat, it will send the child into fight or flight. It will send the amygdala has this limbic dysfunction. In fight or flight, when the child's gone into fight or flight, then any hope you might have had as a parent to reason with your child is out the door. That child cannot process what you're saying. That child cannot listen. That child is in a state now, which is a very primitive state, almost a pre-social state. So this is more than just an interesting model about, you know, how the different systems are affected by stress. This is something that gives us a tremendous tool for the work we do with children or the work we do with parents and educators. Because now we start to know what we're dealing with, and we can start to figure out strategies that recognize the brain state that the kid is in.
I love it because I think it's just so important to understand exactly how kids' brains work when they are under stress, and you know which systems are activated and online and which ones aren't. Because it is so important that we respond appropriately. That's why I have many parents say to me, oh, you know, I try to talk him and we try to, you know, reason through the temper tantrum, and it just doesn't work because that whole part of the brain is not online at the time. And we have to wait actually until the child is back in a place of calm and safety before we can start to engage them again with speech and language, those sorts of parts of that part of the brain.
If there was any chance that we had to make a transcript of this talk today, I would take what you just said, I would put that at the front. I would put it in bold. I would underline it because that's what this is all about.
Yeah, that's so good. So this leads to my next question because I think we can think of the brain as being, you know, the triune brain. We have those three stages of the brain that you talked about, but you also bring in a very new concept that I hadn't heard of before I read your work called the interbrain. And love for you to spend just a few minutes on that, because I think that that is almost as important as the encapsulated brain within our skulls.
So what we know is that at the moment of birth, the brain explodes. There's this, we call it exuberant burst of synaptogenesis, that where 700 new synapses form every second. And that lasts for a couple of years. Now, what does that mean? It means that most of the growth of the brain grows postnatally, after birth. But you have a problem now. And the problem is, so we refer to this newborn as, in essence, a fetus outside the womb. However, inside the womb, you had, and we had some wonderful graphics I could we could share with you if you wanted them, about showing what this looks like. Inside the womb, you have the umbilical cord. So you needed something to take the place of the umbilical cord. And that something is the interbrain. So the interbrain is a wireless hookup from the caregiver's limbic system to the baby's limbic system. It's a limbic-to-limbic hookup. This channel, this neuroceptive channel, this interbrain connection, is a constant throughout the lifespan. It's huge. So when we work with, say, troubled children or troubled teens, the first lesson that we try to teach our own clinicians is that it really doesn't matter what you say to a child or teen that's in red brain, because that kid is processing neuroceptively what your own limbic system is feeling. If you're angry, that is what he will hear, regardless of the words you use. In fact, there's been some very, just the last thing I'll tell you, Rob, very interesting studies now on the role of neuroception with the elderly. And what we're finding is the greatest obstacle to well-being in the elderly is being alone, not having interbrains. Yeah. So this is an exciting new development. And I can tell you who to read about this, but my own favorite is Alan Fogel.
Right. So you're saying that this is basically a connection from one brain to another that is nonverbal.
Yes.
It is essentially a reading, what, like body language or what?
Yeah. So body language, tone of voice, gestures, pupils, gaze, smell. So right. All of these factors, all of these senses are being processed by the child. Now, just so the people understand what you just said, this is going on without us being aware of it. And it's going on in us as adults too. So we're processing things about somebody before they even say a word. We've already formed a judgment.
And the purpose of this interbrain then is for the mother and child initially to be connected to, in order for that child to survive, really, because it's born so prematurely.
Yeah, because it's born so premature. So, I talked at the beginning about you've had this enormous increase in stress load. And so the baby has to self-regulate. But a baby can't self-regulate. You know, if a baby's cold, they don't think, well, I should pull up my blanket and I'll be warm. And we show a video, and it's a fabulous video. And parents can see this on the web with Michael Jr. He's gone into the delivery room. His baby daughter has literally just been born, and he's in there. He's going to make a nice little family movie, and the kid is alone on a hard table, and she is crying hysterically. So, you know, it's a full blown out tantrum, and in a split moment, he forgets about his home movie, and he becomes a dad. And he starts to say, his tone of voice lowers and his speech slows. And he says to her, "Daddy's here. Don't worry. You're not alone. Daddy's right beside you." And what happens is, people can't believe it when they see it, but we've seen this over and over. The child, the baby stops crying instantly. Why? Because the greatest threat to a child at any age is to be alone. So neuroception is this subcortical way of looking, of scanning the world, is constantly looking for threat or safety. And what his voice does, she doesn't understand what he's saying. She's months and months and months away from that. But her limbic system responds to this message, I am not alone. And that is a message, by the way, that she will carry buried deep in her subcortex for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. This is cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in self-regulation, you've explained about how the brain is involved and stressors, but we have bodies attached to the brains. And I'm just wondering how self-regulation actually involves the body or shows up. How are the brain and body connected in this?
Okay, I got to tell you guys are asking absolutely wonderful questions. They are not easy questions.
They weren't meant to be easy.
They are not. There's a real interesting story, again, to be told here. So we have two different kinds of pathways going from our brain down to our organs or our organs up to our brain. So the ones from the brain down to the organs, those are called efferent pathways. They send efferent signals. And the ones going from the organs up to the brain are called afferent pathways, afferent signals. Now, what's really interesting about this is that the ratio is 80% of those pathways are from the body to the brain. Only 20% are from the brain to the body. So the body is constantly sending up signals to the brain. And so it could be we're talking about the heart, or we're talking about the gut, and the signals are, you know, everything's good up here. You know, you can go and solve a problem if you want. You know, we're good to go. Or the signal is, hang on, boss. You know, you got to stop. What are you doing? Math? No more of that. You know, this is draining all my energy. Now Tony's question had buried in it a very interesting phenomenon. So I'm going to use myself as an example. I gave a big talk to educators across the country last month, and at the very end, they said, "You know, Stuart, you're Canada's self-reg guru. If anybody can tell us about, you know, how to self-regulate, it's you." So I started to laugh, and I said, "I think you got the wrong guy," because early in February, I ended up in a real serious crisis in the hospital because I had bleeding duodenal ulcers. So here's Dr. Self-Reg, can't even practice what he preaches. How could I possibly, I had a whole mass of the damn things. So how could that have happened? How could I have been unaware that I had duodenal ulcers? Well, it's a very interesting answer. Because stress is pretty high on all of us right now. COVID stress is tough. And on top of that, you know, I've got a large organization that's scrambling to deal with all of our commitments. And now if you really want to know stress, I've got two teenagers living at home.
Yep.
Okay.
That tops it off.
Yeah, okay. So stress is pretty high on me. Now, looking back on it, Was my gastrointestinal system, was it telling me that there was something wrong? Yeah, it was telling me. It was sending little signals. And I can remember saying to my wife probably about a year ago, you know, I said, I'm having trouble with certain foods. I better not eat this. And then I said to her a couple of months after that, you know, I'm having trouble with dinner. Maybe I need to not eat dinner and just have a larger lunch. So what was happening was the signals were there, but I was ignoring them. I was suppressing them. And that's what stress does to us. So we can literally not feel it at all. And that's one of the problems that we have, say, with cardiovascular disease, which, by the way, we're seeing in kids now. So we cannot feel any, we don't feel any of those afferent signals, or what happens is we feel them like sort of subliminally, but we suppress them. We intellectualize them. We come up for a reason, you know, and part of me knew that something was wrong, but I had a lot of commitments and now's not the time for me to, you know, go on to Panto, which I ended up doing.
Yeah.
So instead, you know, you're going to drive through it. And the answer is you can only ignore, you can only ignore afferent signals for so long. And then they're going to make themselves known. Now, the last part of Tony's question is the most important. You know, we've done a lot of work, for example, on obesity as being a dysregulation of the stress cycle. And the guru on that is actually a guy called George Crusoe. And so there are changes. Stress causes changes in the adipose tissue. And the adipose tissue produces leptin. And leptin is what regulates our appetite. So it basically stops producing leptin. So, you know, if you say that to people, if you say, you know, like, you know, stress is having all these effects and you may not know it because right. It's shutting down your awareness, your interoception, then they say, oh my God, I'm screwed. What can I do? If you know, I got a lot of stress, I can't avoid the stress of COVID. So how can I, you know, I might as well just sit and wait for the, you know, for whatever is going to explode on me to occur. But there is something you can do. And that's why we designed Self-Reg. So what we can do is we start to monitor our stress. And we have various ways that we can monitor our stress. And then we figure out what our stresses are. And then we start to reduce our stresses. You reduce the stresses that you can. Maybe you can't reduce the stress of COVID, but there's a lot of ways that we can begin to manage that stress and reduce other stresses. So, Tony, that's a long answer to what is in fact a very, very important question.
Right. Because so you're implying, of course, that the body and the brain are just so connected.
Yes.
And it goes both directions. And
yes.
I'm just reminded of actually something that you wrote in your book that astounded me. And I want to just read a quote from your book because I looked it up while you were talking. And it's this, because it sounds like this is all new science, but this is your quote. One should not attempt to cure the body apart from the psyche or the mind. And this is the very reason why most diseases are beyond the doctors, that they do not pay attention to the whole as they ought to do, since if the whole is not in good condition, it is impossible that the part should be. The psyche or the mind is a source both of bodily health and bodily disease for the whole man, and these flow from the psyche. So if I was to read that, someone, you might say, oh, that's someone who's just read the ACE study or the Adverse Childhood Experience yeah. study. It was written like 2,500 years ago by Plato.
Yes. Yes.
And so I find that astounding that, you know, this is, it sounds like it's all new science, but people have known about this for centuries.
So I only have one thing to add. So, you know, our whole theory is a theory of homeostasis. And you know, it's based on the work of Cannon and Selye. But homeostasis was first written about by Plato and Aristotle. So... Mm. They use a different word, but same term, but the same ideas.
Let's go back to kids for a second. And you make a distinction between misbehavior and stress behavior.
Yeah,
I want to just talk. Yeah, because I mean, a lot of families will come up to me and say, you know, what's the problem? Our son is mean, and we're worried because he doesn't show any remorse. He's doing this on purpose to get our attention. You know, what can we do about this? And then it's kind of falls flat when we say, oh, this is just a stress behavior. You know, they're just stressed to deal with the stress. They said, no, he's doing this on purpose. Define misbehavior and stress behavior, and how can we tell the difference? And what do we see more of?
First, just the definition. Misbehavior refers to behavior that is intentional. So the child is aware of what or youth is aware of what they're doing. They're doing it on purpose. Stress behavior are behaviors that are caused. So the child's not choosing what they're doing. It's caused by processes deep within the limbic system. And the child may not be aware of what he's saying or doing, may not be aware of, may not respond to you trying to explain the consequences for this behavior. Parents are pretty good at making this distinction between misbehavior and stress behavior with infants. Not always, by the way. I once had a father come in and say to me that his 9-month-old had bit the mom on the weekend, did that mean that his child was going to end up going to jail? Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Just calm down.
Yeah.
But when children start to speak, there's this shift in parents' attitudes that somehow if they can speak, then they can understand rules. They can, and so it became very important for us in the work we were doing with preschoolers and toddlers, preschoolers, and then young children, for parents to understand that there is a very important difference here, and that if you treat a stress behavior, so something caused, as if it were, here's a great example. You know, the kid hit Johnny on the playground. We get the over and over. Yeah. So it's probably going to be a stress behavior. And if you saw it, you would know it was, because it was automatic. It's not, you know, it's just an explosive behavior. But if you treat it as a misbehavior, you are going to dramatically increase the stress load on that child. And you can end up producing the very thing you're trying to prevent. So then the next part of the answer is, your question was, you know, well, how do we know? How do I know which is which?
Yeah.
And there are signs of misbehavior, and there are signs of stress behavior. So when it's misbehavior, you know, we talk about them as tells. When it's misbehavior, the kid basically, the kid speaks too much. He talks too much. And, or what he does is he starts off by repeating what you just said. And you can tell what he's doing is he's trying to give himself time to think it through. Or his tone of voice changes, it gets a little lower. So there's lots of tells, and they're all in one of the books. I think it's in the in Self-Reg book. The signs of stress behavior are actually, for me, they're more interesting. But anyways, I give a list of all the tells in Self-Reg.
Right.
So for stress behavior, the child's voice also changes. It goes up. The pitch goes up. And so it becomes a little bit more shrill, a little staccato. His speech becomes a little staccato. The kid may become very perseverative. He may repeat the same thing over and over. And if you look, you'll see that his face is probably pale, and even the back of the hands get pale. Now, that's a great example of polyvagal, because what's going on here is that this kid is getting ready to run. And so the brain is sending this message down, the neuroception is sending this message down to get ready for flight. So all the blood is being shunted into the heart, so that it can engorge the major muscles, the trunk and the legs, so that he can take off. So we can actually see, once you start looking for it, you can see when it's stress behavior. And if you look really closely, you'll see some very interesting things in it going on with his eyes. His pupils either constrict, which is a nice sign of anxiety, or they may dilate, which is a nice sign of fight or flight. Anyways, the point is that we don't want to see these, when they occur, we don't want them to become entrenched. We don't want this child to see this as some sort of power dynamic. Really what we want to use are the techniques of positive psychology, if it is a genuine case of misbehavior, so that we're teaching and not punishing. We really don't believe in punishing at all. Mm-hmm. The reason I got into this, the reason why I started to do this work, was because I was working up in the far north. I was in Yukon, and I was in Carcross, and there was this one kid, and he was young. He was like 10 or 11, and really came from a highly stressed home environment, and so on. And so he was very aggressive with the other kids, and they were having trouble keeping him away from the junior school, basically. Yeah. So we started to work with this kid, doing self-reg with the kid. And it turned out that he was a wonderful little artist. He started to create using plasticine. He would create village scenes. And I actually have one. I'm looking at it right now. Do you want to see it? I can show it to you.
Well, that's okay, but our listeners won't be able to see it. That's the only problem.
Oh, no, that's right. Well, they're wonderful little scenes. And what was happening was you're changing the whole trajectory now, because not only are you teaching him how to get to calm, but you are empowering him. You are giving him, you know, the one thing that was missing with all the yelling. You're giving him a sense of pride, a sense of self. So even if it's, so I want to say to parents, you know, even if it's a case of misbehavior, there's so much we can do to change that. And I want every parent to go away feeling hopeful. And even if it's a teen, even if it's a young adult, I always remain hopeful.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about self-regulation, and I feel like we're warmed up to the point where it would be great to have you just briefly summarize the 5-step process that you are so well known for.
Well, the first step is called reframing the behavior. And that means whenever your kid does something, I don't care what it is and I don't care where it is, stop and ask yourself why. And why now? Now, there's a couple of reasons why we want parents or teachers to do that. First of all, it stops your own limbic reaction. You know, if the kid's done something that's upset you, if you just insert that pause, it gives you a chance to calm your own limbic system down. But now with reframing, we're going to go a little bit further. Because what we really want to know is, well, what led up to this? Were there stresses involved? What was he like? I once gave this talk to a group of educators in Peterborough, and it was on the explosive child. So Rob was talking to me about Ross Green. So they had been reading Ross's book. So, and I've told Ross's story too. So I started off and I said, okay, I'm going to tell you something that that everybody's going to want to yell at me for, but there is no such thing as an explosive child. So as predicted, everybody yelled at me.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, now I need a volunteer, somebody who's got a clear case of an explosive child. So I had one teacher volunteered the story, and it was a kid who, he was 11 or 12, and he just exploded out of the blue after the lunch period. So I said, okay, now I want you to think back. When he came in that morning, did you have any sense that maybe something was off? And so she stopped and she said, well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I noticed that he had his hoodie pulled down over his head and he slumped down on the desk. So that tells us something pretty interesting. The signs are there. There's probably something going on at home, or maybe he hasn't slept, maybe didn't eat. But this is a kid who's come into school in a high stress. We use something called a Thayer matrix. So he's come into school in a low energy, high tension state. And that's pretty much, if a kid has what we call an explosive behavior, it's because he was in low energy, high tension. But as a teacher, you got a problem, because this is a stress on you as a teacher. But you've got another, you know, 23, 24 other kids, you know, this is a very stressful job. And so what happens to the teacher is exactly what I was talking about before with myself, with my ulcers. You push it aside. You maybe it'll be okay. Maybe we'll get through the day. It'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And in fact, so then we went around the room and it turned out that everybody started reframing like crazy. So that's what we want to do. We want to insert that pause so that you can start to think about, you know, where is the child on the Thayer matrix? What might have precipitated this? Was there a sudden increase in, you know, and so on and so on. The next step is identify the stressors. Step 2. So this is not easy. You know, Tony, I haven't actually explained what stress is. And I think I should.
Please do.
Okay. So we use the original canon definition. A stress is anything that triggers in the brain processes to maintain homeostasis. So the example that he gave was cold weather is a stress, because what it does is the body has to stay at around 37 degrees, you know, an average temperature of 37 degrees. Yep. So if it's cold outside, the body, the brain responds by triggering shivering or teeth chattering. These are, you know, these micromuscular movements that generate heat as a byproduct and that keep our, but like any muscular contraction, they expend energy. So a stress is anything that requires the brain to trigger some metabolic response or a physiological response that burns energy to maintain homeostasis, whatever that means. So if you think about it, I mentioned before when Rob and I were talking about babies that, you know, a baby is overwhelmed by new stresses at the moment of birth. And in fact, the most influential study ever done on this was by Porges with Stan Greenspan, where they went into the NICU and looked at the effect of lowering stress on baby's health. And what they found, you know, by eliminating noise and you can figure that out. And what they found was that they cut in half the number of days that children were in the preemies were in the NICU. What that tells us for Tony is that stress, the original sense, is very physical, it's very biological. The stresses that that Cannon was looking at were noise, light, crowds, so the first domain of stress is very biological. But then we have emotional stress, we have cognitive stress. And this is what my last book is all about. It's about, you know, all the stuff that kids are doing in school. That's a cognitive stress. It makes a huge demand, not just on the mind. It makes a huge demand on the body. Thinking, problem solving are all body, whole body phenomena. And then the last two are social and pro-social. So what we want to do when we're doing step two of self-reg is we want to look at all five of those domains. I've got a kid that's, you know, had a meltdown. And so I'm going to start off, you know, the first thing I'm going to think about is emotional stress. But then I'm going to stop and I think, well, what about the physical side? Was the physical stress too great? What about the social stress that the child's under? This is a school situation, you know, it's very stressful to lose it in front of your friends. So we're constantly looking at all five domains plus something that Rob and I talked about when we did the soft drink example. We're looking at what are called hidden stresses, things that we wouldn't think of as a stress. So there are very interesting studies coming out, for example, on the effect of living close to an airport. It causes a sharp increase in cardiovascular disease. And the noise of the planes here, you may not notice it. You know, you become habituated to it, but it remains a hidden stress. Then the next step, step three, is reduce the stress. And so the example we give there is, you know, let's say I've got a kid in class and he finds other children, all the kids around him, very stressful. So we put up cardboard portable carrels on his desk and it dramatically increases their academic performance because you are reducing the social stress. We can figure out ways to reduce all of the stresses. The next step is the pivotal one. Step four is reflect. And what we want the child to do is we want the child to know what it feels like to be calm. And what we're seeing, we feel, is a generation of children and teens that do not know what calmness feels like. And then the last step is a very technical one. It's called restoration. And that's really referring to the parasympathetic reflex. So the parasympathetic reflex, if it's overused by adrenaline, overused by the release of cortisol, it loses its ability to bring us back into homeostasis. So we have to restore the balance in a system called the autonomic nervous system. But you can't get to there. You can't get to that restoration step until you have reached calm. You can't do it. You can't say to a kid, well, you know, I want you to go do yoga now because you know, I read this study saying that in England, they're having kids do yoga for 15 minutes a day. If I've got a kid that's in a high aroused state and I just told him, you got to sit still for 15 minutes and I don't know, say a mantra, that's a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. Anyways, those are the five steps.
But it's interesting because you make a big distinction between calm and quiet. I mean, we sometimes think that those are two synonymous words, when in fact, they can be the opposite. I mean, you can have a quiet child who is the opposite of calm.
Yeah, so that's a huge point. So I'll never forget one day I was in my office and the therapist came in and wanted me to see a video of somebody called Super Nanny. And she had this thing called the nanny stool, or the, I don't know what the stool was called. But anyway, she had a five-year-old. And I'm looking at this five-year-old and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this kid, you know, at the very least, I'm seeing ADHD and probably a dozen other things. So she takes the kid and she puts the kid on the stool and then she holds her there. So, oh my goodness, this is restraint. Mm-hmm. And so what restraint does is it really, you know, you do it hard enough, it sends the kid into freeze. So now the kid's in freeze and you say now, and Danny says, well, now she's compliant. Now she's listening. No, it's the opposite. It's what Rob just said. Now, if I take that kid who is not uttering a sound and I hook her up to my machines, what I will discover is that her brain, she has what's called cortical arousal. Her brain is doing this like crazy. Her heart is beating 120 beats a minute. She's in heightened sympathetic arousal. So calm is the opposite. Calm is when the cortical arousal is slow waves. Calm is when the heart slows down. So now it's beating 75. So calm is if I hook her up to galvanic, we can test stress by the skin, I get nothing. So this is a very, very important distinction because, you know, parents, you know, it's tempting to say, well, you know, if you yell enough or punish enough, the kid will be quiet. Yes, you can send them into freeze. And in fact, a lot of damage is done in that state.
Long-term damage too.
Long-term damage, yeah.
Yeah.
So I know our listeners are going to be curious about your resources and all your work. And I'm wondering if you can point them in the right direction.
Okay. First, read my books. And then we have on our, we have a couple of websites, but for Canada, the Canadian website is self-reg.ca. And you can get all kinds of materials there for free. Because we're trying to get this information out there for parents to download. And then we also have a parent newsletter and a parent foundations course.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much, Stuart, for talking with us. I feel like we could spend a whole other episode talking about many of these topics. There's a few questions I would love to get to still at some point. So maybe we'll have you back at some point. But thank you so much for sharing.
My suggestion would be we do 9 more sessions, one on each of your questions.
Okay, that sounds good. I know. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
I love that calorie-dense conversation we had with Dr. Shanker. I'd just like to summarize a few of the points I took away from this conversation. Here's 3 of them. Number 1, don't assume that your child's primary problem is self-control. It could be a problem with regulation. Your child's developing brain needs your help to notice and manage stressors. Secondly, it starts with you. Self-regulation involves knowing the state you're in and how to release your own tension so that you can be calm and then notice what your child needs. And thirdly, self-regulation is a learnable skill. I so want to encourage you with that. You can learn how to self-regulate and how to teach your child these skills so that you can all lead optimal lives. If this conversation has been helpful for you, then I am grateful. We're grateful. And would you consider sharing it with a friend? We would also love for you to hop over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review so that these podcasts will get into the hands of other parents. So that's it for today. At Smart Family Podcast, we're all about bringing you the advice of experts and thought leaders because we want to equip you to love being home.